a film with three brains. It's 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 a film with three brains.
Oh my god, you guys are freaks.
Welcome to the Film with Three Brains. I'm Sam in San Francisco.
This is Sean in Chicago.
And Cohen in Maplewood, New Jersey.
And we are reviewing The City of Lost Children from 1995. I chose this movie because it's our first foreign film, but two, it's one of those movies that I keep a short list of movies when people like quirky movies or movies that they might not have seen that I think they're, it's kind of a, let's see kind of how strange will you get. this is that one of those movies on that list. When I try to describe it to people, the most I'd ever say is, you know, it's about a guy who can't dream. So he kidnaps children and hooks them up to a machine so he can try to experience their dreams. And one of the kids he kidnaps, there's another guy who's obviously trying to find the kid, and all the weirdness that kind of comes together to just get his little brother back, which is a really, I think, inadequate way of describing it. But
it's one of the hardest movie plots to describe.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So I was watching it and Vivian came in and sat down. She's like, you know, I recognize all these scenes and images, but I don't remember what this movie is really about. And I was like, I think that I've had to watch it a few times before I could say
it can be hard to follow.
Yeah. Which was what I like about it. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I probably saw it right around the time it came out, because I was familiar with Delicatessen and I really liked it. And so when this came out, I was like, oh, the guys who did Delicatessen, awesome. And then I really don't think I saw it since, because I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as Delicatessen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, I liked it. And then, you know, he went on to make Amelie, which made a huge splash in the U.S., you know, more than any of his other films. And then he did Alien Resurrection, which was pretty terrible. So I don't know if I ever really revisited City of Lost Children after that first time. I don't recall. I watched it with sort of a sense of what's going to happen next. You know, I wasn't quite sure. I couldn't remember exactly. I was a few times. I was like, wait, what's going on?
Yeah, I had to back up a couple times just to make sure I knew who just said what or what was just about to happen.
Right.
The first time I saw it, I think I was living with you, Sam. So, you know, I had no choice.
Right. I forced it upon you. I think it's tough when you're reading the subtitles and it's a very visual movie.
Yeah.
And there's so much going on visually. And to me, it's like I've seen it enough times now that I don't have to be staring at the subtitles. And I feel like every time I watch it, I notice something that I didn't notice before. And I'm like, how could I have not noticed that before?
Yeah.
But it's a confusing movie. And I saw it when I was at the University of Wisconsin. They had a little theater on campus for like the film school, you know, school type people, that they'd play a movie on Friday nights at 10 o'clock, and I just had been walking by and saw the poster and I was like, I have no idea what this is, but I'm gonna go watch it. So I saw it alone. I just sat there the whole time, totally confused, and then it started to slowly fall into place about 5/6 of the way through the movie. It's like only the last like 10% or whatever is where I was like, did I actually understand the whole story? But I was like, boy, it was more confusing than any movie I'd seen. The only thing I could compare it to, because it came out the same year, was 12 Monkeys, which was also a fairly confusing movie until it starts to fall into place. But really, I hadn't seen anything like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think 12 Monkeys is a very good comparison. Terry Gilliam in general is a pretty good comparison to Jean-Pierre Genet, who direct, you know, him and Mark Caro are directors of City Lost Children. They have similar aesthetic, you know, has a lot in common with movies like Brazil. And yeah, it's unique in that too. There aren't many filmmakers making movies like that. And they're never, I mean, even now I'm hard pressed to think of anyone who has that sort of strange visual style other than Terry Gilliam. And he doesn't make many movies these days. I mean, there's people, you know, I think about someone like Wes Anderson, whose films are all very stylized in a very specific way, you know?
Oh yeah.
But even his are, you know, it's not like this. It's just heavily stylized in a different way, you know? I don't know.
I think of Tim Burton a lot for some reason.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe it's just all the set design and the feel, you know,
Yeah, and some of the characters are surreal, you know, the Siamese twin lady and her movements. Like, to me, just watching her in the scene, and she scratches the other one's arm and stuff like that. Like, that to me is just incredibly creative, that's straight out of Tim Burton. Like, that's something he would do.
Yeah.
Similar sensibilities, I guess.
Yeah. I didn't know this until just recently looking up about the movie, but the way they got the color scheme for the movie, you know, is that a lot of the actors, a lot of the scenes, they would have white face makeup on, and then they would in production, they would adjust the color to make the faces of the characters look like flesh, so it would throw everything else off.
Yeah.
So that, which I thought was a pretty neat effect.
It's interesting. That's definitely sort of an effect of the year in which it was made, because today you wouldn't have to really do that, probably.
Oh yeah.
The software has become so sophisticated that you can isolate, you know, tones and stuff and manipulate things pretty granularly these days.
I think another thing about the time that this was made, this was like the first cyberpunk movie. I mean, or not cyberpunk.
You mean steampunk.
Steampunk, movie that it'd come out. And I mean, like, you could go back and say, like, Jules Verne, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, that movie was in that style, you know, and it's an old movie. But back then we didn't call it, you know, nobody called it that. Whereas this seemed like it was on the forefront of the steampunk, you know, rise. And so stylistically, I thought it was something that no one else had been doing at that time.
I've always been surprised there's not more steampunk movies out there. You know, there's a few here and there, but none of them usually are all that great. I mean, I feel like The Rocketeer has slight sort of steampunk sensibilities here and there, but it's not really steampunk. And then there's like, what was that terrible Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow?
Yes. That was just, say that.
I mean, it's just terrible. It looked cool, but it wasn't a very good movie.
I think it ruined the genre.
Yeah, it did. It kind of like shit all over it. Everyone's like, oof. Boy, like, can't make a movie like this ever again.
Right.
And even like, what was the one recently that, what was that called? Where all the, it's in the future and all the world's cities are on wheels.
Oh, Mortal Engines.
Yeah. Mortal Engines. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, based on books, but I didn't see the movie, but that also looked like it had some steampunk sensibilities to it as well.
Yeah. You might like that. We saw it in the theater. I'm not sure what got us to check it out, but it's got some interesting ideas. Not all of them work, but it's worthwhile.
Yeah, I think it's a damn shame there's not more good. I love steampunk if it's done well, but it's so rarely done well, or it's so rarely even attempted outside of anime and, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess what was that term?
Wild Wild West.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, that did.
You just drove a terrible one. I was like, I know where he's going. You didn't even get to say Will Smith. So there's also The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which did not do well. No. There was Hugo, which is way more recent.
And that was good. I guess that's sort of steampunky, isn't it? Huh? I never thought of it as such.
Yeah, I think it is. It's got Jude Law in it again, who was in Sky Captain. Really not a long list here. And the other one that stunk, which was a really popular book series, was The Golden Compass. That was something that
HBO has a new series out right now. It's Dark Materials. I think we watched a little bit of the first episode, but not all the way through. I haven't seen it really yet. But I saw that movie with Nicole Kidman and what's his name? Daniel Craig, I think, was in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't very good. I have the books. I just never read them. They're just sitting on a shelf. I never read them.
I read the first one.
Was it any good?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was something where they ruined the movie. I thought that when I read the book, I was like, this has the makings of a really good series. Like, this was going to be a Harry Potter competitor. That was obviously, the goal, I think, of the
movie. Well, sure, yeah.
But right, well, anyone. But I thought that they failed with the movie. It's like, just the. And I don't know, some goofy guy at the front of the flying boat thing is like, tonight we ride. And I was like, so cheesy. It's like, I don't know if you remember that scene. It was in the previews. I was like, you just made something that's supposed to be magical, totally cheesy. I want to go back to City of Lost Children because our listeners are probably like, oh, I still don't understand.
What the hell are these dipshits talking about? Right.
Yeah. So it has, at the time, I didn't know Ron Perlman from anyone else. And I originally, I thought Ron Perlman was French. And I did. So when he showed up later as Hellboy, I was like, oh, he got an American movie, so I had no idea that he was actually, he doesn't speak French. He just memorized all his lines phonetically to be in this movie. Yeah. But Ron Perlman's the hero. He's kind of a slow thinking, circus strongman who goes to find his, adopted, little brother who has an insatiable appetite, and so it's more about his adventure of going through this world that we can't.
He makes the movie that kid eating everything is just the best.
That's so funny. It's such a simple thing. It's hilarious. I mean, he's so cute, and the look on his face every time he's eating is so matter of fact. Yeah, he's like, "That's right, I'm eating this sausage." So.
The sausage is like as big as his head.
You're right, it's enormous.
He'll bite people's hands if they're available.
And he's the only innocent little kid in there. All the other little kids act more like adults. They actually act older than Ron Perlman.
Part of the plot, if we do a brief addendum to your synopsis, the other part of it that we haven't spoken about yet is the sort of Oliver Twistian thing where there's all these orphan children on the streets who work for sort of a criminal mastermind type. And then there's the Cyclops people, the one-eyed weirdos who are kidnapping them all, right? For the guy who can't dream.
Right.
I mean, it's a little convoluted.
Yeah. And then the guy who can't dream pays them by giving them a device so that they can be Cyclops.
Right.
It's confusing, and I want to say that there's something, maybe Sean or you can enlighten us. He's better at reading the symbolism than I am. I'm so straightforward, but I was like, there's maybe I'm trying to throw you a bone here. But these guys are blinding themselves and then hooking themselves up to a device that gives them, that inputs the vision directly into their brain. It almost looks like they're looking through night vision goggles and they're making themselves deaf. It's like they're using machines I don't know if this is right, but I want to say somehow I got the impression like you can't trust your own eyes or ears. So you have to sacrifice them and use machines instead. But yeah, I don't know if I'm reading too much into it. What do you get out of it?
I won't take credit for this. I read a little bit of the writers, I think, speaking about the duality of capitalism and how there's different, you know, at the end, the whoever survives, there's kind of two boats, and one boat is are the children, kind of two families. So it's like the new family of one and Miet and the kids, and then there's the leftover experiments from the lab, which are the clones and the woman and there's just two diverging. I don't know. I think they were hinting at that, but I don't think it's a really big deal. My impression, I think the first time I saw it was the way that they focused on Christmas and materialism and stuff like that. And that, yeah, and then I think that that whole religion and crazy Cyclops thing was kind of like they were nutty purists, and somehow they were trying to strip away, you know, all this crap that other people are missing, or I'm not doing a good job of explaining that feeling, but you know what I mean, that they are trying to lead people in a direction that obviously is not fun, not natural. I don't know about the technology, but it's, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think you really need to dig too deeply into it because it's so messed up.
Yeah.
That it's whatever you want to take from it. I mean, the whole dream and nightmare thing is the crux of it. And even that was kind of, you know, only marginally important.
I'm sure philosophically minded people could definitely, you know, gather any number of sort of points of view from it, because there's a lot going on. But, and I mean, on the surface, it just seems like definitely a sort of technology versus the natural, you know, sort of dichotomy, I suppose, or some shit.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say it created a really weird, like the movie itself is a little bit spooky at times. It's not for little kids, but the one thing I saw in The City of Lost Children that I have not seen anywhere else is someone who witnesses themselves being killed through their own.
That was crazy. Like
that was like such a, when I watched it this time, I was like, oh my gosh, that's such a unique scene. Like this is something that you would have thought that Saw or someone stole, you know, they would have loved to have done that, you know, like, you know, that was very unique.
Yeah.
And he was being infected with the crazy flea aggression potion.
Yeah. Which was also very unique.
Yeah. Because I don't know if they infect people in different ways, because he was more sadistic about his, you know, he's like, oh, you don't like music? And then here's a knife in your eye. You know, it was crazy how it affected him differently than one who, you know, just tries to strangle him yet, even though he loves her.
Well, I think that's what the potion does. It makes you kill. And I will say that Ron Perlman has highlighted that scene as his most uncomfortable acting that he's ever had to do. He felt horrible having to choke a little girl. I mean, spoiler, she lives. Don't, you know, let the audience know. But, to him, it was just a terrible thing to film. And he recalls it as the worst thing he's ever had to do on film.
Yeah. And the slaps. I mean, those look real.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, when I was watching, I was like, oh, Jesus. that looked really convincing.
Yeah, just a word on Ron Perlman and that whole. So I agree. I was like, how the hell is he speaking French so well? And I think maybe he was being a little modest about, oh, I just learned it phonetically, because it wasn't like the way, say, Andre the Giant learned it phonetically and just said those words in Princess Bride. And you can kind of tell it's not his first language at all.
Yeah.
Perlman, I think, it sounds French, it sounds very passable, but then what I put together this time was that he is the big strong man, he's not very smart, and so his he doesn't use proper grammar. He kind of just spits out a verb or a word rather than speaking full sentences, and so that probably made it a little bit easier to kind of focus on pronunciation and But still, it's amazing that he even attempted it, for one. I would like to know how he got involved in it in the first place.
I would imagine just from the way he looks. I mean,
yeah,
he did, you know, he did before that, he did Quest for Fire. That was like his first film role where he played a, you know, Cro-Magnon man or caveman or whatever. And then he ended, his big break was in Beauty and the Beast as the Beast, you know, and that old, I don't know if you guys ever saw series with, it was Linda Hamilton and him.
Yeah.
So, you know, and those were in the mid to late, I guess Quest for Fire was in early 80s. Beauty and the Beast was mid to late 80s. Something like that. So you got to imagine, I mean, why cast an American in this role except for the way he looks, you know?
Yeah. So
his physicality was, you know, really big, strong man, kind of, you know, with that thick forehead and you know, angled features. I mean, he's an odd looking dude for sure.
Yeah.
Well, the director, Jean-Pierre, has said that he likes to choose people with distinct facial features, and you know, the guy who can't dream has a very distinct looking face. The clones, very distinct looking.
Who, and that guy, that actor is in all, I don't know if he's in all of his movies, but he's in most of them. He's certainly the lead in Delicatessen. He's in this, and he's even in Alien Resurrection. And so is Ron Perlman, actually.
Yeah. He said that for Amelie, he said Amelie looks like an elf with doe eyes. She was perfect.
Sure.
And you know, I thought it was funny because, you know, he's being asked about how'd you pick Amelie, and it's because of how she looked. I don't even know if you can do that anymore. Is that legal in today's?
Yeah, definitely. They might not be so overt and honest about it.
So, but no, it's just, you know, he says that he likes people with memorable facial features.
Sure.
There's no one who has a jaw like Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
As far as the language, the only performance I can think of that kind of can top that is Giovanni Ribisi. He's in a movie called Heaven with what's her name, Kate Blanchett. This is after our time frame, so I think it's like a Kieslowski. Anyway, he does it the whole movie in Italian, in perfect Italian. Plays in Italian. And speaks all in Italian, and then Kate Blanchett's like, she can speak Italian, but she's, you know, a foreigner. Anyway, I just was like really impressed when I saw that, when I saw him in that, and it was like, geez, I mean, is he? I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I should look up whether he you know, grew up in Italy or something. But well, I just was really impressed him.
I've never heard of that movie, which is weird, but written by Krzysztof Kieslowski and directed by Tom Tykwer. That's fascinating. I don't know. I've never heard of that. That's crazy. That's crazy. Huh.
What happened to him?
Who?
Yeah, what did happen?
Giovanni Ribisi, because he was in some good movies. You know, Saving Private Ryan, Virgin Suicides, Boiler Room. He was in a bunch of movies, and like, nonstop, Lost in Translation, then all of a sudden he's like disappeared.
Well, you know, he was in oh my god, I just blanked, the Dances with Smurfs.
Oh yeah,
Dances with Smurfs, James Cameron's movie
Avatar.
Jesus. Yes.
He is going to be in the next two Avatar movies.
The next four? Isn't he making whole?
He's making three?
I think he's making two, three, and four all at the same time. That's what I'm saying. Maybe Giovanni Ribisi is just, he's it. He's in the Avatar, he's in the Avatar business for the foreseeable future. I don't know.
Yeah. Did you guys really like Avatar, by the way?
These films till the day he dies?
Yeah.
I threw in our first Weird Al quote.
Nice. I can't believe you beat me to it.
We got to ring a bell or something. Da-ding! Oh, no, we got to play an accordion.
Making these movies to the end of time. Nice. Yes, I liked Avatar, but Jesus, like awards and stuff? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, the sequels are one thing, but people loved the first movie, and I don't know.
I thought it was fine. It's fun, but like to say it's anything other than like a B genre film is ridiculous. I mean, it's a pretty tired story that's been done to death.
What's funny? Yeah, so that's why you call it Dance with the Smurfs. Yeah.
Right.
It's a rip off of that.
Right. No, I thought that was the alternate name. I thought when you buy the DVD, it says that in small print underneath Avatar right. Dances with the Smurfs.
It's Avatar is how I learned to stop wearing and love the bomb.
All right.
So we're talking about City of Lost Children.
Yeah, we were, yes.
You wouldn't know it if you tuned in 5 minutes ago.
It didn't do well at the theater.
No,
not in the American theater, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Not in terms of math or money.
But it has it has a 79% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I love Roger Ebert's quote about it. He's like, I give the film 3 out of 4 stars, but I would be lying if I said I understood the plot.
Yeah, so, it's a little convoluted.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you at least, I didn't know it was the director from Delicatessen, but like if you know. Now knowing him and what it is, you're going to go into that movie expecting to be a little bit confused.
Sure. Yeah. And that's fine. Like you can still enjoy it without really know what's going on. I mean, film is a visual medium, and there's so many directors making movies that are not that visual,
right?
You know, they're just not that visually interesting. Obviously there are still people making, you know, really interesting, who speak the language of film well, people like Steven Spielberg, to, you know, who is always going to come to mind. But there's a lot who aren't, who just don't have a flair for that sort of thing. Just can't, Steven Spielberg actually is the one who said, if someone watches your film on mute and can't figure out what's going on, then you've failed as a director. You know?
Mm.
So I don't think, I think City of Lost Children, all this guy's films probably passed that test. Like, you can tell what's going on for the most part. I mean, yeah, it's a complicated plot, but you can tell, I mean, the conflict is pretty clear, and it's so visually interesting that, you know, if you're not reading the subtitles, you're still going to get something out of it. You're still going to enjoy it, I would think.
I always give credit for creativity. I think that I will forego other things to allow for greater creativity. And I think that it takes risk to make a movie that's somewhat confusing that you have to pay attention to. And the only thing that I can think of recently that does that is anime. You know, a lot of the Japanese things are purposefully done confusing so that you go back and watch them again.
Yeah.
But they don't do that for major releases very often.
Yeah.
This is you have to be sober to watch this movie and paying attention. You're not gonna be just, you know, having a conversation and casually glancing at the film and get anything out of this.
Right.
Although I can see a lot of people not sober, like doing some acid or something and having a really interesting experience. Maybe going straight after watching the movie like this messed up.
Right. Well, I don't want to endorse performance enhancing drugs.
I don't think you need it. But it does have a lot of like Rube Goldberg machines and, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know, to your point on creativity.
Yeah.
There's one of the things about it said potential goofs, and it said, well, this looks like a goof, but it's not. It's the getting the key, knocking the key out.
Yeah,
grating the cheese, doing the magnet, and it's like, well,
that was awesome. Just,
yeah, and it's like, well, they could have just done slid the magnet under the door, and it's like, well, yes, but that's the point. It's they didn't need to do that, but they, you know,
they right. Thought it was...
Yeah, that was. I love that scene. It's so clever and interesting because you don't know what's going on, really.
Yep.
You know, and it has such a great payoff. You're like, oh my god, they just stole the key. That's amazing. But yeah, I mean, I can't remember what movie it was. I definitely saw another movie where they basically just slid a piece of paper under the door and then like took a paper clip and poked the key out and it fell on the paper and they slid it back under. But I don't remember what that was from.
Yeah. And also, but these are kids doing this, so
I mean, but clearly, right. Yeah. But not as interesting. Not as funny.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys noticed, but the sweater that Ron Perlman wears throughout the movie is basically Freddy Krueger's sweater from A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
I have no idea if that's intentional. Probably not, but, you know, it is.
It's the green and red stripe,
horizontal stripe sweater.
The stripes are wider. The stripes are wider than Freddy.
They are, okay. They're a little wider, fine.
I did notice that.
Thank goodness Krueger never gets naked like he did in Yikes. Yeah, there's a lot of clever stuff. Yeah, so yeah, he gives a piece of his sweater to her when she's going into the headquarters, the hideout, which was supposed to be an oil rig or something. I mean,
yeah, I think so.
Like, and that's abandoned. Yeah, it's out in the bay, and it's protected by mines, and like there's so many details. You're like, wow, this is insane, but it's really cool.
For the most part, it looks pretty good too.
Yeah, it still does.
Yeah, it holds up. It's pretty interesting. They must have. I mean, I'm sure the budget was not huge. It was probably pretty low, but, you know.
$18 million.
Yeah, that's not so big. It no. Definitely looks more expensive. Yeah, it looked good.
And they had to, you know, they use some CGI, and they were saying at the time that they made it that they pushed the limits of what CGI could do at that time.
Oh, I'm sure.
But, you know, unlike a lot of other movies from the special effects, you know, and from the mid 90s or earlier, they still look good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love how angular and like spindly the stairs are, and the sets are really claustrophobic, and
yeah,
you know, I mean, France is not a very like, it's generally kind of a happy, open place, you know, and they made it seem like, or I mean, I'm going to assume it's in France, but I mean, like this, whatever this town is supposed to be, it's very, obviously it's dark, but it's just like creepy looking. The whole thing is kind of, you feel put upon while you're watching them walk around the streets and fall into the bay. And,
is the time frame a single night? This all takes place in a single night, right? Or does more time pass?
No,
I think it's a couple nights or
no. I think it's a couple. Yeah,
yeah.
Because they talk about her sleeping with she was a snack for the fishes at midnight, so that's when they're on, which was another device. Like they're on planks that have fish on the other end, and the seagulls are eating the fish.
Right.
So
You know what quote came to mind when I saw that this time? It comes from Austin Powers. It's Dr. Evil. The unnecessarily kind of. Oh,
yeah. And assume it all went to plan. What?
Yeah, exactly. What does he say? The unnecessary complex. I don't even remember the exact quote, but I just came to that. Scott's like, I have a gun.
I can just shoot him right here, right now. Just shoot him.
You just don't get it, do you, Scott?
Oh, love it. But yeah, that was a great little way to watch him die, or almost die. Another spoiler. Yeah. They didn't die.
I don't think this time I kind of understood that the scientist. So, I mean, eventually they give you a good chunk of exposition in the beginning when they're celebrating Uncle Irwin, who is actually a brain in a tank, who was created along with all these other people by the scientist who we don't know yet. And they explain about, you know, this is the clones and this really intelligent man who can't dream, who's a crank or cronk or whatever you call him.
Yeah.
So that gives you the gist of that, but you still don't know who, you know, and then the clones are all like, who's the original? I'm the original. And so you don't meet him until later. But sort of the whole, like, who's to blame for all this? And even the scientist himself doesn't know until he has to piece it together toward the end, I guess.
I think that goes back to the interpretation of of kind of innocence versus kind of like technology or what yeah. science could yeah. do. So just, you know, quick show of hands here. Is this one of the top three talking brains in a tank movies or not?
Along with Dune. let's see.
And don't forget Imelda May.
Imelda May. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. Oh, that's
Dr. Harfer.
Harfer. Oh, so, yes, that's going to be number one.
Yes, but this is definitely number two or number three in the Talking Brains in a Tank movies.
Yeah,
totally.
But you're hitting on kind of the theme of control, like, you know, free will, and everyone that's innocent kind of is being forced to do something that they don't want to do. The kids, I mean, everybody, yeah. Except for maybe the scientist or maybe the head of the Cyclops people, but... yeah, there's this like need for control, but I don't know who the villain really is, because you think it's kind of Kronk, whatever his name is.
I don't think he is a villain.
I don't think he's supposed to be, but he seems like one.
I think this movie just drops you in the middle of a really crazy scenario that evolved, and everybody's just doing what they do to survive. And then we watch like kind of how it works and how it falls apart. Like, I don't think there's not one villain. There's not one person in control or anything. It's just, here's this strange world and all its rules, and you're going to figure it out as the movie goes along, and that's it. But it's not like there's actually a hero on the mission to change any of it. He just wants to get the kids safe. That's it. Like, he's not trying to change the world.
Yeah. Right.
So have we beat this thing to death or what?
No.
Okay. The beatings continue.
Until morale improves.
All right. We have some questions to answer.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
How old do you think you have to be to enjoy this movie?
Oof. 65.
Yeah.
No. No, I don't know. You definitely have to want to seek out a strange movie. I mean, you're not going to go straight from Frozen to this.
Speak for
definitely not for kids. Not oh, just kicked my mic. Yeah, I can't imagine a teenager or younger is going to care.
But it's not inappropriate or anything. It's just
no, definitely not. Yeah,
yeah.
It's just I don't think they'd be bored.
You'd right. have to be a teenager who was like Lydia in Beetlejuice to go back to Tim Burton. You right. have to be a little bit unusual. Right. I think.
Go ahead.
I think I was 20 when I saw it, and I enjoyed it. Maybe 21.
Yeah.
But I was also really into movies and. I looked back, I was watching about 120 movies a year during those years.
Oh, so yeah.
I just imagine how much I could have learned in college if I actually wasn't watching. But anyway.
Well, I mean, in 1995, I was in the middle of, you know, studying film in college. And so this was right up my alley, this sort of thing. I mean, we kind of grew up in a time when independent film became what we think of as independent film. You know, in the early 90s, it wasn't the beginning of independent film, but it was independent film becoming, you know, what we think of as independent film. And at that age, I was seeking out anything interesting I could, you know, constantly looking for, you know, indies and foreign films and whatever, documentaries, doesn't matter, anything interesting, original, you know, some I'd never seen before. So when it, you know, Delicatessen came first, and it kind of blew me away how much, it was so interesting, and I loved it. And so, of course, when this came out, I seeked it out immediately.
So yeah. I went back and looked at things that came out in 1995. So, you know, City of Lost Children, which we discussed here. And then there's a number of other good movies that year. Toy Story 7, which I know Sean loves. Babe, which Cohen now loves. Braveheart, Sean loves. Clueless, Billy Madison, Heat, The Usual Suspects, 12 Monkeys, Mighty Aphrodite, Tommy Boy, and did I say Billy Madison? So anyway, so of all those movies from that year, there's only a couple of them that I've watched more than five times, the other two being Toy Story and 12 Monkeys. Like, the other ones were great, but I don't go back and watch them over and over. Whereas this one, it's because it's so visually interesting and that I go back and watch it. And I know that I'm in a very small minority for that. But you know, when you think about the other great movies from that year, it's like, yeah, I've seen The Usual Suspects again, but it's not a movie you're going to watch over and over.
I would just like to point out that in your list of movies from 1995, you did not mention, much to my horror, Waterworld.
Oh, God.
Or, come on, man.
I have not seen that since we saw that in the theater together.
Well, you should, because it's a fucking masterpiece, dude. Come on.
Or he's going to make you see it because he's going to review it.
Right, yeah, exactly. That was the triple header. That was the Waterworld, 9 months, Braveheart,
and Braveheart.
That was one long day at the movies.
We paid for each ticket, I'm sure.
Yes,
of course, always.
Yeah, I'd pay twice, just to be honest. All right. So is it worth going back and watching? You guys know my opinion.
Definitely.
Should it be remade?
Oh, boy. I don't know.
Yeah. Nah.
I think it'd be a tough task to remake it.
I see this could be made into like a short, like Netflix or Amazon series. Like, there's enough here. There's enough unexplained stuff here
that someone could extrapolate
on it and make something out of it.
There's very little there's a lot you don't know, you know, as a viewer, you don't really know or understand the whole history of the, you know, the scientists and the oil rig. What the hell is all that about? You know? And the Cyclops and the, you know, the children and the city. Yeah, you're right. It would probably make an interesting series if anyone felt so inclined.
And then where you can watch it, you got to rent it. I couldn't find anywhere that you could watch this one for free.
No, I think I rented it as well.
I rented it on Amazon Prime, I think.
Yeah, I think I did too.
It probably was on Google and other things.
Yeah.
Whatever, yeah.
You can find anything on the Google.
The Google.
Yes. Yeah.
Indeed. What else?
That's it.
We covered it all?
I think so. Didn't have that many factoids from this because most of these people have not been in very many movies or have done anything else since, with the exception of Ron Perlman. We did mention Amelie that's after our time period for reviewing, but then that's his hugest film, but not much to the, not, I couldn't find that many factoids. I looked to see what happened to Miette, the leading girl, and really not much of anything. She went to college and did other stuff and then has come back and done a little bit of acting. But it sounds like that's not going to be her lifelong career.
Hmm. I couldn't figure out why his name was One. In English, his name was One, and they were all pronouncing it One.
Yeah.
It probably doesn't matter, but puzzled me.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't either. I think he's a big fan of the song by Metallica.
That's probably it.
Or maybe the song by U2. One of them. All right. So what do we have for our next movie?
Well, funny you should mention 12 Monkeys.
Are you going Terry Gilliam?
I am going with Terry Gilliam, not 12 Monkeys, though. We're going to go with Time Bandits.
Ah,
sweet.
Oh, you just remind me of the one factoid that I was going to say. But I don't know these. I don't know why I put these two movies together in my mind, because they're not related at all. But Ron Perlman was in The Ice Pirates.
Oh, yeah. No, I know.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Yes. Zeno, I think his name was.
Yeah.
But for, you know, the Time Bandits is one of the films that is like, this is a Coen movie. Like, if anyone ever mentions Time Bandits, like, you love that movie. I saw that movie with you at some point, not at your house. You know, I didn't see it with you at the theater. But yeah. It was one of those things that is like, there's only one person in the world who's associated with this movie, and it's you.
Yeah, I made my wife, my brother-in-law, and his girlfriend watch it the other night. I threw in the Blu-ray, and I'm like, we're watching this, people.
What was the response? Or I guess we'll get to that later, huh?
Yeah, but I mean, it was there might have been some snoring involved. Fools!
I'm glad you picked Terry Gilliam too, because I, you know, he's on my short list also for The Fisher King.
Yeah.
I like The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I don't want to go into him too much. We'll talk about him next week, but pretty much I'm a fan of him.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, when I picked him, when I picked Time Bandits, I wasn't really considering it as a sort of a companion piece to City Lost Children at all. I wasn't thinking about it at all, but it seems appropriate.
All right.
Kind of shift it towards that.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think as far as things go, this was our 10th episode, and this is by far our best review.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. To the power of 10.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have high hopes for Time Bandits, but really, as far as things go, this City of Lost Children is our best review.
Agreed.
C'est magnifique.
This kind of this kind of blew my mind. How good it was.
All right, that's it for The Film with Three Brains.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Adios. It's The Film with Three Brains.